Chapter 12. The Memorial of the Passion. The use of the blood of Christian children in the celebration of the Jewish Passover was apparently the object of minute regulation, at least according to the depositions of all the defendants in the Trent trials. These depositions describe exactly what was prohibited, what was permitted, and what was tolerated, all in meticulous detail. Every eventuality was foreseen and dealt with. The use of blood was governed by broad and exhaustive case law, almost as if it formed an integral part of the most firmly established regulations relating to the ritual. The blood, powdered or desiccated, was mixed into the dough of the unleavened or solemn bread, the shemurim, not ordinary bread. The shemurim, in fact, three loaves for each of the two evenings during which the ritual dinner of the Seder was served, were considered one of the principal symbolic foods of the feast, and their accurate preparation and baking took place during the days preceding the advent of Pesach. During the Seder, the blood had to be dissolved into the wine immediately prior to recitation of the 10 curses against the land of Egypt. The wine was later poured into a basin or a cracked earthenware pot and thrown away. The performance of the ritual required only a minimum quantity of blood in powdered form, equal in quantity to a lentil. The obligation to procure blood and to use it during the Passover ritual was the exclusive responsibility of the head of the family, that is, a responsible male with a dependent wife and children. Bachelors, widowers, guests and employees, all those without dependent family, were exempt. In view of the difficulty of procuring such a rare and costly ingredient, it was anticipated that the wealthiest Jews would provide blood for the poorest Jews, an eccentric form of charity benefiting heads of families disinherited by fate. Samuel de Nuremberg reported that, the evening before Pesach, when they stir the dough with which the unleavened bread, the shemurim, is later prepared, the head of the family takes the blood of a Christian child and mixes it into the dough while it is being kneaded, using the entire quantity available, keeping in mind that the measure of a lentil is sufficient. The head of the family sometimes performs this operation in the presence of those kneading the unleavened bread, and sometimes without their knowledge, based on whether or not they can be trusted. Maestro Tobias restricted himself to recalling that every year, the blood, in powdered form, is kneaded into the dough of the unleavened bread prepared the evening before the feast, and is then eaten on the solemn day, that is, the day of Passover. This testimony was confirmed by Mahamir, the son of Mose the old man of Würzburg, as well as by the convert Giovanni de Felter, who had seen his father's chat Sacchetto perform the ritual while still living at Landshut in Bavaria. Isaac Oda Gridel, Angelo de Verona's cook, admitted to kneading the shemurim containing blood for 8 years, preparing it for the celebration of the Seder. Joave of Franconia, Tobias' domestic servant, recalled the custom from as much as 17 years back, when she was in service with a rich Jew from Würzburg. Mose de Bamberg, the traveller staying with Angelo of Verona, in his long deposition, stated that he had personally performed this operation when he was head of the family in Germany. Later, when he moved to Italy, he had seen it performed at Borgo San Giovanni, in the Piacenza region, in the home of moneylender Sicolosicla Iscek, who inserted the blood into the unleavened bread while his wife Patina kneaded the dough. Vitale, Samuel de Nuremberg's agent, attested to the custom as a result of having seen it performed for 3 consecutive years by his uncle, Salamone, at Monza. The subject matter of these depositions was also confirmed by the women involved. Bella, the wife of Mayor de Würzburg, reported that she had seen her father preparing the Schmierim from the time she was a child at Nuremberg, in preparation for the first 2 evenings during which the Seder used grains of dried blood in the dough. Sarah, Tobias' wife, recalled that her first husband, Elia, whom she married at Marburg, had used blood for this purpose, and that she had also seen the practice in many Jewish homes in Mestre. Verna, Angelo de Verona's sister, stated that she had seen the brother placing the dried blood, dissolved and diluted in water, into the dough of the unleavened and so-called solemn bread, the Schmierim, which was kept under surveillance, and that to be eaten during the first 2 evenings of the festival, during the Seder. Angelo himself took a bit of the Christian child's dried blood and dissolved it in water, then poured the water containing the blood into the dough with which they then made the unleavened loaves, 3 of which Angelo and the other members of his family and Benna herself ate during the Passover evening feast, while the other 3 members ate it the evening of the next day. Angelo de Verona's report was rather more detailed. After briefly recalling that the Ashkenazi Jews take a small quantity of the blood and they put it in the dough with which they later make the unleavened bread which they eat during the solemn days of the Passover, he went on to provide a detailed description of the rite of preparing the Schmierim with blood. First of all, he explained to the judges, the ritual action was carried out as a sign of outrage against Jesus Christ, whom the Christians claim is their God. He then continued, supplying whatever clarification he considered dutiful and necessary. Eating unleavened bread with Christian blood in it means that, just as the body and powers of Jesus Christ, the God of the Christians, went down to perdition with his death, thus, the Christian blood contained in the unleavened bread shall be ingested and completely consumed. How much truth there was to this key anti-Christian interpretation of the presumed Jewish hematophagia blood-eating through the medium of unleavened bread, and just how much was invented to please the inquisitors concerned, is unknown. It is however a fact that Angelo supplied a very colorful and credible representation of the ritual, utilizing the correct formulae from the classical Jewish liturgy. They place the blood in their unleavened loaves in this manner. After placing the blood in the dough, they knead it and stir it around to prepare the unleavened bread, the Schmierim. Then they poke holes in it, pronouncing these words, Cheni Chereshu Kol Hoyavia, which, translated, means thus may our enemies be consumed. At this point, the unleavened loaves are ready to be eaten. This Hebrew invective is not an invention. It may in fact be found among the blessings and curses pronounced during the so-called Haggadah of the Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah, just before the feast dinner. On this occasion, the reading of the various formulae was accompanied by the consumption of vegetables and fruit, in addition to fish and the lamb's head, recalling, by means of a pun on their Hebrew names, the type of blessing or curse which the reader intended to pronounce. Leeks are called Kati, and the invective associated with its name was known as Shia Karechu Ikaresu in the Ashkenazi pronunciation, Kol Hoyavenu, that is, may all our enemies be exterminated, consumed according to Angelo. The original inspiration was, as usual, biblical and prophetical, Mitch. 5, 9, and all thine enemies shall be cut off, which os hoivecha iacaretu. At this point, it becomes much more difficult to dismiss the insertion of these Hebrew language execrations into the ritual of the Christian blood added to the Sodom unleavened bread as merely the extemporaneous and extravagant invention of Angelo da Verona, softened up with torture. From Samuel de Nuremberg and Angelo da Verona, from Maestro Tobias and Anna de Montagnana, all the accused at Trent were agreed in affirming that the head of the family, who was required to perform the task of directing the reading of the Haggadah, did not shake the blood into the wine before starting the seder or during the initial phases of the celebration, but only when they were about to recite the 10 curses of Egypt. Recalling the years of his stay in the Jewish quarter of Nuremberg with various employees such as Lazaro, Giosia and Moshe Lof, Moses Ehrensbach, the teacher of Tobias' children, stated that the head of the family placed the blood in the wine at the precise moment of the commemoration of the so-called 10 curses, that is, the plagues of Egypt. The learned Moses Würzburg, the old man, explained that the head of the family takes a bit of the blood of the Christian child and drops it in his glass full of wine. Then, putting his finger in the wine in which the blood of the Christian child has been shaken, he sprinkles the table and food with it, pronouncing the Hebraic formula in commemoration of the 10 curses, which God sent to the refractory Egyptian people who refused to liberate the Jewish people. At the end of the reading, the same head of the family, referring to the Christians, utters the following words in Hebrew: "Thus we beseech God that he may similarly direct these 10 curses against the Gentiles, who are enemies of the Jewish faith." Giovanni de Felter, the converted Jew, recalled the years of his youth, spent in Lower Germany, when his father performed the ritual of the Seder of Passover. Both evenings, my father took blood and shook it into his chalice of wine before beginning the Passover dinner, then sprinkled it on the table, cursing the Christian religion. After the reading of the last part of the Haggadah, the head of the family performed the act of adding the blood to the wine to transform the wine into a potion symbolically intended to represent the cruel death of Israel's enemies, immediately before the 10 curses. This part of the text of the Haggadah opens with the words, "The Lord made us leave Egypt with a strong hand, with the arm extended, with immense terror, with signs and with prodigies. This is the blood, Zehadam." The reason why the hematic fluid of the Christian boy was dissolved in the wine of the 10 curses at this point was revealed by Angelo da Verona. The Jews performed this act in remembrance of one of the 10 curses which God inflicted upon the Egyptians when they held the Jewish people in bondage. One of the plagues was God's transformation into blood of all the waters in the land of Egypt. As usual, Israel Wolfgang provided some sense of order for these various rituals. The young painter recalled participating in a seder held in the house of a certain Jew named Chopel, at Gunzenhausen, near Nuremberg, in 1460. Chopel used coagulated, pulverized blood, shaken into the wine prior to the recitation of the 10 plagues. This was accompanied by the following declaration in Hebrew: "This is the blood of a Christian child, Zehadam shel Gwarkatan." According to what may be gathered from Israel Wolfgang's account, after the reading of this fragment of the Haggadah, which began with the words "Zehadam, this is the blood," the head of the house brought the ampoule containing the powdered blood to the table, added a bit of the contents to the wine in his chalice, and recited the analogous formula beginning with the same words, Zehadam, but in reference to the blood of the Christian child, not in reference to the first plague of Egypt. He then went on to the reading of the 10 curses, the sprinkling of the wine onto the table, and the recitation of the invectives against the Goyim, the Christians. Obviously, the formula, "This is the blood, Zehadam, of a Christian child," was transmitted from generation to generation orally. The text of the Haggadah was alleged not to contain this text. Israel Wolfgang's revelations continued. In 1474, he said he had participated in the celebration of the Jewish Passover at Filter, at Abramo's house, Abramo being a moneylender in that city. On that occasion, Wolfgang had seen the head of the family add the blood to the dough of the Sodom unleavened bread, migzo equals mazot, that is, the shimurim. During the evening ritual of the Seder, Abramo de Felter, in preparation for the reading of the 10 curses, came to table with a glass phial containing a small quantity of dried blood, the size of a nut, and shook a pinch of it into the wine, pronouncing the usual formula of the Zehadam, "This is the blood of a Christian child." He then began the recitation of the plagues, pouring the wine onto the table and cursing the Gentiles hostile to Israel. Lazzaro, employed at Angelo da Verona, also told the judges that he had seen the rite performed by his uncle Israel, the influential Ashkenazi banker at Piacenza, who occupied the function of treasurer in the Jewish community of the Duchy of Milan. According to him, Israel, during the recitation of the plagues, diluted the blood into the wine, pronouncing the Hebrew words which meant, "This is the blood of a Christian child, Zehadam shel Gwargadon." In this regard, Mose of Bamberg confirmed the descriptions of the other defendants, referring to the one of Mahar, a moneylender active at Tortona, with whom he had stayed as a guest in the past, during the Seder of Passover. As often happened, one, in the act of adding the dried blood to the wine before the recitation of the 10 curses, turned to his guests with the required Hebrew phrase, "Zehadam, this is the blood of a Christian child." It should be obvious that only someone with a very good knowledge of the Seder ritual, an insider, could describe that precise order of gestures and operations as well as the Hebrew formulae used during the various phases of the celebration, and be capable of supplying such a wealth of detailed and precise descriptions and explanations. The judges at Trent could barely follow these descriptions, forming a vague idea of the ritual, which was so foreign to their experience and knowledge that they could only reconstitute it in the form of nebulous and imperfect images. The Italian notaries, then, had their work cut out for them in attempting to cut their way through this jungle of incomprehensible Hebrew terms, pronounced with a heavy German accent. But on the other hand, what interested them, beyond the particulars of difficult comprehensibility, was establishing where these Jews used Christian blood in their Passover rites, adding it to the unleavened bread and the wine of the libation. Imagining that the judges dictated these descriptions of the Seder ritual, with the related liturgical formulae in Hebrew, does not seem very plausible. Gwarkerton, little Christian, the expression used in referring to the ritual murder victim, who was usually nameless, is said to have been used during the act of adding his blood to the symbolic foods to be exhibited and consumed in the Seder dinner. This expression, although not at all neutral in view of the negative and pejorative connotations attributed to Christians in general, was certainly less contemptuous than the term normally used by German Jews with reference to a Christian child. For example, the word Schex possesses the sense of something abominable, while the feminine, Schexer or Schex, is a neologism used, in particular, in reference to Christian girls engaged in romantic relations with young men of the race of Israel. The diminutive Italianized term of endearment, Sigazello, was in use among the Ashkenazi Jews of Venice until relatively recent times. At any rate, the words Schex, Schigez, or Siesk, employed in a contemptuous manner to refer to the children of those faithful in Christ, viewed as some of the most abominable expressions of all creation, was in widespread use in all cities with communities of German Jews, even in northern Italy. It should be noted that the term is absent from the records of the Trent Trials, but the terms Gwa, literally, people nation, with reference to Christians generally, and Gwakatan, little Christian, in the sense of a child belonging to the faith in Christ, were used instead. In his fierce invective against the Jews, the Venetian convert Giulio Morosini did not fail to censure the virulently anti-Christian education imparted by Jews to their children, according to Morosini, as well as the offensive terminology utilized by Jews in Hebrew to insult Christian children and their churches. "You are accustomed to instilling in those little children, along with their mother's milk, the observance and the concept of the law and the holy language, with Hebrew names for many things. This is so that they may easily and soon understand the law and Bible. But at the same time, you inculcate hatred against the Goyim, that is, the Gentiles, by which name you refer to the Christians, never missing a chance to curse them, and make your children curse them." Thus, the name most frequently used against Christian children is Siketazim, that is, abominations, which is also the word you use in reference to the idols, as you are accustomed to call them. In the same manner, you abominate our churches with your synonym, Tongeva, which also means abomination. And you very often warn them to flee the Tongeva, not to speak to the Skits and other similar terms of abuse. In the eyes of the Ashkenazi Jews of Trent, it was obvious that the ritual obligation to use the blood of Christian children in the Passover celebrations was exclusively incumbent upon heads of families, and not on other members of the community. The rule, announced to the judges by Israel, the son of Samuel de Nuremberg, was that Jewish fathers of families in the feast of Purim, before dinner, take a small quantity of the blood of a Christian child, put it in their cup full of wine and sprinkle the table with it. Angelo of Verona placed it in the category, not of ritual regulations, but of customs Hebrew, minha, Latin mos, and, always with patience and in a summary manner, explained that the established custom is that the head of the family, and no one else, must place the powdered blood in the unleavened bread in the time of the Passover. Mose de Würzburg, for his part, reported that, up to the time when he had been the head of a family in various places in Germany, it had been considered obligatory to provide blood for the Passover rites. Subsequently, since he no longer occupied the role of head of family, he had been exempted from performing this duty. Mose de Bamberg also stated that, as long as he had been the head of the family in Germany, he had procured the blood for the Passover Seder. He then went into service with various Jewish families at Ulm and other centers in Franconia, and was considered exempted from this custom. In this regard, It should be noted that the preeminent role of the head of family, paterfamilias, a rendering of the Hebrew Ha'el Ha'Beit, patron of the house, in the celebration of the Passover rites, particularly in the medieval Ashkenazi environment, is attested to by many manuscript and printed texts with comments on the Haggadah of Pesach. Among other things, these texts stress that the obligation of the ritual washing of the hands, netilat dam, at the beginning of the Seder was only incumbent upon the head of the family, almost exclusively entrusted with the reading of the Haggadah, while all the guests were exempt. Binyamin Temer of Nuremberg, at the beginning of the 16th century, testified to the existence of this custom, stating that he had observed it to be widespread in all the Jewish communities of Germany. "I have noticed that, most of the time," wrote the German rabbi, "the ritual washing of the hands in the Passover Seder is performed only by the head of the family, while the guests do not wash their hands at all. On the other hand, procuring the raw material required for performance of the blood ritual was not an easy job, involving costs which the heads of poorer families could not afford. It was therefore anticipated that the heads of poorer families were exempt from a task which proved too costly for them, as was unhesitatingly admitted by the ancient expert Mose of Würzburg when he explained to the inquisitors of Trent that the Jews naturally require the blood of a Christian child, but if they were poor and could not afford any blood, they were relieved of the expense. Rich Jews, often in a mixed spirit of prodigality and magnanimity, took over the beneficial task of assisting the poorer Jews by supplying the precious fluid required, although obviously in minute amounts." Isaac Odegridel, Angelo of Verona's cook, recalled that, when he was in service with the head of a family at Kleberg, a rich relative of his wife supplied them with a small preparation of dried blood at no charge, stating that was customary to do this for the poor. The blood had been acquired from the well-known Rabbi Shimon of Frankfurt. Mose of Bamberg, the professional traveler, also recounted that he had had a dependent family until 1467, and, since his indigence was well known to all, he was supplied with powdered blood of a size equal to a nut by Salomony, a rich merchant from Lower Germany, and sometimes by Chevo, a wealthy Jew from Parchim in Mecklenburg, who gave him no more than half a spoonful. The rite of the wine, or blood, and curses had a dual significance. On the one hand, it was intended to recall the miraculous salvation of Israel brought about through the sign of the blood of the lamb placed on the doorposts of Jewish houses to protect them from the angel of death when they were about to be liberated from slavery in Egypt. It was also intended to bring close a final redemption, prepared by means of God's vengeance on the Gentiles who had failed to recognize him and he had persecuted the Jewish people. The memorial of the Passion of Christ, relived and celebrated in the form of an anti-ritual, miraculously exemplified the fate destined for Israel's enemies. The blood of the Christian child, a new Agnus Dei, and the eating of his blood, were premonitory signs of the proximate ruin of Israel's indomitable and implacable persecutors, the followers of a false and mendacious faith. The old man, Mose of Würzburg, stressed both the significance of the blood rite and the curses, from the positive memorial of the blood of the lamb on the doorposts of the houses and the negative memorial of the Passion of Christ, scorned and abhorred. According to the laws of Moses, it is commanded of the Jews that, in the days of the Passover, Every head of family should take the blood of a perfect male lamb and place it as a sign on the doorposts of the dwellings. Nevertheless, since the custom of taking the blood of the perfect male lamb was being lost, and, in its place, the Jews now used the blood of a Christian boy. And they do this and consider it necessary as a negative memorial of the Passion of Jesus, God of the Christians, who was a male, rather than a female, and who was hanged and died on the cross in torment, in a shameful and vile manner. Israeli, Samuel of Nuremberg's son, referred to the rite's ancient value in a response to his judges relating to the significance which came to be attributed, over time, to the mixing of the blood into the unleavened bread. "We consume it in the unleavened bread," he said, "as a memorial of the blood with which the Lord commanded Moses to paint the doorposts of the doors of Jewish houses when they were the slaves of the Pharaoh." On the other hand, Vitale of Wissenberg, Samuel S. Agent, preferred to confer a second meaning upon the rite, that is, that of an upside-down memorial to the Passion of Christ, considered as an emblem and paradigm of the fall of Israel's enemies and of divine vengeance, forewarning of final redemption. "We use the blood," he declared, "as a sad memorial of Jesus. In outrage and contempt of Jesus, God of the Christians, and every year we do the memorial of that passion. In fact, the Jews perform the memorial of the Passion of Christ every year, by mixing the blood of the Christian boy into their unleavened bread." The origins of the ritual of the use of blood in the Passover dinner are not very clear, nor do we know the names of the rabbinical authorities who presumably taught it. The only defendants in the Trent trials able to shed any light on the subject were Samuel de Nuremberg and Mose de Würzburg, both of whom possessed a high degree of Hebrew culture, the fruit of many years of arduous study in the most famous Talmudic academies, Yeshivat, in Germany. Neither Samuel nor Mose were able to provide precise answers in this regard, entrenching themselves behind the hypothesis that the ritual was based on ancient traditions which were only transmitted orally, for obvious reasons of prudence, and that no written traces of it remain in the texts of ritual law. Just when these traditions were formed, and why, was, for them, an unresolved mystery, enveloped in the mists of the past. Samuel vaguely attributed these traditions to the rabbis of the Talmud, Ea de Sapientias in Partibus Babyloniae, who was said to have introduced the ritual in a very remote epoch, before Christianity attained its present power. Those scholars, united at a learned congress, were said to have concluded that the blood of a Christian child was highly beneficial to the salvation of souls, if it was extracted during the course of a memorial ritual of the Passion of Jesus, as a sign of contempt and scorn for the Christian religion. Over the course of this counter ritual, the innocent boy, who had to be less than 7 years old and had to be a boy, like Jesus, was crucified among torments and expressions of execration, as had happened to Christ. Another praiseworthy addition was circumcision, to make the symbolic similarity more obvious and significant. We do not know how firmly convinced Samuel was of what he said, but it seems certain that the judges were highly gratified with this kind of macabre confession. This does not detract from the fact that the allegations of this Jew, at least in historical and ideological terms, if not in relation to the practical application of the alleged ritual in the case of Little Simon, were quite plausible. Mose, the old man of Würzburg, was even vaguer than Samuel, noting that the blood ritual was not recorded in any of the ritualistic scripts of Judaism, but was transmitted orally, and in secret, by rabbis and scholars in Jewish law. Mose nevertheless confirmed that the Christian boy who was to be crucified during the rite in commemoration of the Christ's shameful passion had to be less than 7 years old and of the male sex. In accordance with Samuel de Nuremberg's statements, we believe that the blood of the sacrificed Christian boy is of great benefit in the salvation of our souls. It was the custom, attributed to the participants in the blood ritual, to perform collective acts, even if only symbolic, to stress their intervention in the ceremony, such as that of touching the victim's body. All those present placed their hands, now one and now the other, as if to suffocate the child, because the Jews believed that they render themselves meritorious before God by demonstrating their participation in the sacrifice of a Christian child. Isaac Oda Gridel, Angelo de Verona's cook, in effect, affirmed this in his confession, by describing his own participation in a ritual child murder committed at Worms in 1460, according to him. In a certain sense, this behavior recalled the collective funereal rituals proper to the Judaism of the German territories during medieval times, testified to, among other things, in the writings of Rabbi Shalom of Wiener Neustadt. These writings include a description of the Haykafoff, the circular procession around the coffin of the deceased by the persons present at the funeral to drive evil spirits away from the soul of the deceased, which reveals undoubted links with the Kabbalah. The collective custom of placing the hand on the casket or the tomb to implore divine mercy in favor of the deceased. And finally, the custom of placing a tuft of grass, a clod of earth, or a stone or pebble on the mound to testify to their own presence at the burial. While Samuel de Nuremberg remained more or less deliberately vague with regards to the origins of the custom of using the blood of the Christian child in the rituals of the Jewish Passover, he was very precise in discussing the persons who had transmitted and taught him these regulations orally. David Sprintz had actually been his rabbi and teacher, with whom Samuel had studied lovingly and with great success 30 years before, in the yeshiva of Bamberg, and later in the yeshiva of Nuremberg. Samuel knew that Sprintz had since moved to Poland, but didn't know whether or not he was still alive. David Bell Sprintz was actually a rather well-known rabbi. Born in 1400, he had governed the Talmudic Academy of Bamberg until 1448, and moved to Nuremberg around the middle of the century, taking control of the local yeshiva. He was still alive in 1474, carrying on his activity at Poznan in Poland. Samuel's information in this respect was therefore correct, although we have no way of knowing how much truth there might be in his assertions relating to the subject of the teachings which Sprintz is alleged to have imparted orally in relation to the blood rituals. It is, however, a fact that three German rabbis, all of top-level importance, were implicated in the Trent trials in various ways relating to the transmission of traditions relating to ritual child murder, the use of blood in the Jewish Passover and the contemptuous commemoration of the Passion of Christ. Together with David Bell Sprintz of Bamberg, we find the names of Jordan Mester Moshe of Halle, who also moved to Poznan just like his predecessor, and Shimon Kates, president of the Rabbinical Tribunal of Frankfurt am Main. It seems hardly accidental to me that none of the Ashkenazi rabbis, from the most famous to the least well-known, active in the German-origin Jewish communities of northern Italy are mentioned in the trial records. The only rabbis mentioned are ones whose activity was always carried on in Germany. The observation that neither Italian Jews nor Italian Jewish communities were ever accused of committing ritual child murders compelled the Trent judges to investigate this phenomenon in order to determine whether or not the Italian Jews were simply unaware of the custom or rejected it as contrary to the principles of Judaism, in contrast to the Jews of Germanic origin. If he had been able to speak freely, Samuel, from the lofty height of his Hebraic doctrine of Ashkenazi origin, might have replied with ill-concealed scorn that Italian Jews were not authoritative because they were ignorant in terms of rabbinical culture, not very observant, and very careless about the observation of ritual standards. Instead, he restricted himself to admitting that Italian Jews did not possess this custom in their texts, nevertheless adding, immediately afterwards, that it appeared in the texts of Jews from overseas, an intentionally inexact term, perhaps an allusion to the Judaism of Babylonia and, indirectly, to Ashkenazi ultramontane Judaism. On the other hand, even if we consider the confessions of Samuel and the other defendants to have been sincere and valid, and even accepting the realities of the dissemination of a ritual of this kind among the Jews of medieval Germany, it appears beyond doubt that, as also emerges from the records of the Trent trials, in the world of Ashkenazi Judaism, there were people who rejected this ritual, considering it in conflict with Jewish law. The persons responsible for the scandalous plural child murders at Endingen, in Alsace, in 1462, confessed that they had feared that any one of them might have revealed the details of the crime to the elders of the local Jewish community, knowing that the elders would have unhesitatingly reported them to the police authorities. Returning to the facts of the Trent case, at least according the confession of Samuel de Nuremberg, in the days preceding the Jewish Passover, the defendants are alleged to have instructed Maestro Tobias to meet two German Jewish travelers passing through Trent in those days to inquire whether they were prepared to agree to abduct a Christian boy and conceal him in Samuel's house. But the two Ashkenazi Jews, David and Lazaro of Germany, decisively rejected the proposal, notwithstanding the fact that it was accompanied by an offer of the considerable sum of 100 ducats. They had no intention of getting mixed up in matters of this kind. The words of the two travelers clearly reveal their capacity as emissaries from the Jewish communities of Germany, who were, as usual, invited to Italy every year, in the spring, to arrange for the purchase of cedars for the autumnal feast of the Capanne or Frascate, little sheds and covered market stalls, the Jewish feast of the autumn harvest, Sukkot. In general, the objective of these specialist wholesale suppliers of ritual oranges for German Judaism was the Italian Riviera, particularly San Remo. Lazaro and David, on the other hand, were headed for Riva on the Lago di Garda, where they knew that what they needed could be found in the green orchards surrounding that delightful body of water. Even the commemorative pamphlet on Little Simon, who was now a saint, published in Rome 100 years after his death, with the obvious intention of recalling the facts relating to his martyrdom through education and admonishment, found space to praise the noble act of these two Jews and denouncing a ritual which they found detestable, considering it a true and proper betrayal of Jewish teachings. The consideration that precisely a clearly hagiographic source, such as the summary of the life and martyrdom of St. Simon, child of the city of Trent, a text which is moreover openly anti-Jewish, should preserve and translate their words in a sense of positive appreciation, constitutes grounds for reflection. If nothing else, it sounds like a confirmation of the existence of a general belief that Ashkenazi Judaism was anything but monolithic in this sense. They, Lazaro and David, prudently responded that they did not wish to commit similar follies and that they, with Moshe, wished them ill, because God did not command such things. On the contrary, he says, "Thou shalt not kill," and that child murder was a new ceremony and against the law, which did not wish God's followers to shed innocent blood, such as that of a child, just because the child was a Christian. And if they thought about these things properly, they would discover that they were entirely invented, because there was no basis for them in the texts. Apart from that, they said that it was not right for a Jew to eat blood, as these men wished to do, by kneading the unleavened bread with a certain amount of blood. This same Giovanni da Felte, the converted son of Schatt, a person far from inclined to find anything justifiable in Jews and Judaism, had no difficulty in admitting that, in Germany, the ritual of using the blood of Christian children in the ceremonies of the Jewish Passover was only practiced by fundamentalist Orthodox Ashkenazi sects. The same summary of the life and martyrdom of St. Simon briefly reports the ex-Jews' explicit notes in this regard. The convert Giovanni said that not all the Jews do this, but that sometimes, they do it out of contempt for Christ and in revenge for the tribulations which they suffer because of that same Christ, our Lord. It goes without saying that the problem did not even exist among Italian Jews, the Sephardim, or Oriental Jews, who made up the overwhelming majority of the medieval Jewish world. But this majority was not always the most self-assertive, experiencing a serious inferiority complex compared to an Ashkenazi Judaism which considered itself the inimitable prototype of true religious orthodoxy, which was, moreover, created in its own image and resemblance. Medieval Ashkenazi Judaism made up a hermetically sealed orthodoxy, which fed upon itself, confined by a myriad of minute ritualistic regulations, which they considered binding on all, the mere memorization of which constituted an arduous and almost impossible task. According to Samuel de Nuremberg, the blood ritual was a secret rite, the rules of which were only transmitted with due prudence and circumspection. The convert Giovanni da Felte confirmed this. Entering into increasingly greater detail, Most de Würzburg recalled a presumed rabbinical recommendation to keep the rite a secret from women and girls not having yet reached their religious majority, that is, any age less than 13, because they are fatuous and incapable of keeping a secret. The inferiority of women and minors on a religious level, in addition to idiots and lunatics, was contemplated by Jewish ritual law, halakha, which discriminated between these categories while largely or completely exonerating them from compliance with the positive precepts of Jewish law. It is advisable at this point to mention the most significant texts of anti-Christian polemics, the Toldot Yeshu, literally, the stories of Jesus, or the Jewish counter-gospel. This was a virulently defamatory biography of Jesus dating back to between the 4th and 8th century, disseminated first in Aramaic and later in Hebrew, in slightly different, or grossly divergent versions of the same text, written with the obvious intention of distorting the Christian religious identity by demolishing and ridiculing its memory. Systematic contempt for the figure of Christ and the Virgin Mary, described as a woman of easy virtue, formed the basis of a satirical and mocking tale, presented as a sort of sideshow rivaling the Gospels themselves. It is not surprising that this classic of anti-Christian polemical writing found an attentive and highly satisfied readership among Jews all over the world, from the Islamic countries to Spain and Italy. It is even less surprising that the Jews of Germany adopted this text both enthusiastically and devoutly, as attested by the fact that almost all manuscripts of the Toldot Yeshu appear to have been written by Ashkenazi copyists, and that all of the translations of this text into Judeo-Hebraic dialect are in Yiddish. In one Yiddish manuscript of the Toldot Yeshu, the scribe admonishes the reader to be cautious and practice the necessary circumspection. Hidden dangers might lurk unexpectedly as a result of excessive trust, as well as of unjustifiable complacency. Women, children and the feeble-minded were to be kept at a safe distance, as well as overly curious and intriguing Christians. This treatise should be transmitted orally, and should not be read in public. Nor should it be read to women or children, all the less so to feeble-minded persons. Its reading in the presence of Christians who understand German should certainly be avoided. In another manuscript, also of German origin, containing the Toldot Yeshu together with other anti-Christian scripts, which I recently held in my hands personally, the warnings are even more explicit. The oral transmission of secret texts was energetically enjoined upon all readers to avoid serious hazards and to ward off the serious problems which might possibly originate in surrounding Christian society. Ask thy elders, and they will tell thee, Deuteronomy 32:7. This booklet contains a tradition transmitted orally, by one person to another. It may be put in writing but not printed, for reasons due to our bitter exile. Beware of reading this text before children and persons of scanty understanding, or all the more so before the uncircumcised to understand German. For this reason, he who is wise shall know how to understand and maintain silence, because these are unpropitious times. If he is able to keep silent, he shall receive mercy from God. God's just reward shall be upon him, and his work shall be before him. Publicizing this text is an extremely serious matter, and it cannot be revealed to all, because we can never know what tomorrow has in store for us and we can trust no one. I have written the text in intentionally allegorical and obscure language, because we have been selected as the chosen people and we are permitted by God to use mysterious imagery. Most the Würzburg certainly know which precedents to mention in describing the recommendation to avoid discussion of the counter-ritual of the Passion of Christ and the use of the blood of Christian children in the Passover celebrations among women, children and the feeble-minded, who are unable to keep a secret. Among the Jews of Germany, these precautions were quite understandable. Their violent anti-Christian feelings and expressions, both ideological and ritualistic, in which these feelings found an outlet and a reflection, necessarily had to be surrounded by a protective aura of secrecy and omerta, fatalistic manliness, because any indiscretion in this regard, either deliberately or through naivety, could be the precursor of struggle and tragedy.